I wanted to start this final lecture on the state of the controversy by indicating to you the importance of ordinary people just starting up things that help to contribute to the movement to bring some truth and awareness to this very confused area. Now, the Idea Clubs got started at the University of California, San Diego campus. This is the biomedical campus of the university. They have lots of biology professors there and graduate students. And I got a stormy reception when I gave my lecture. And I had all these graduate students instructed by the professors to come up in the question period and try to make a monkey out of me with their greater knowledge. So I batted them around pretty good. And actually, some of the Christian workers who were sponsoring the event as volunteers were a little bit upset because they thought, well, aren't we supposed to be nice? And I said, well, you're a little rough with these. And I said, well, no, I just treated them the way their own professors would treat them if they came on that way in class. I want them to learn some respect. So now, out of this confrontation, however, did come a very ironic discussion, because some of the students who were there stayed around for hours after I had finished discussing the issues all night. And one young man who was an undergraduate student then, now he's a law student at the University of San Diego about to get his law degree, and he said, well, we ought to make an institution out of these discussions. And that's when the idea of the Idea Clubs, Intelligent Design and Evolution Awareness, came. And they had clubs set up all over the campus to get together people of different views, the scientific reductionists and the biology departments and the students who are critical of Darwinism and the Christians, get together and just discuss the issues. See, and what they're doing is making people used to this controversy as just a part of life that they should accept, and instead of thinking it as something completely outlandish. So now this has become a nationwide movement. They have them at campuses all over the country. They have caps and T-shirts and a website. I think the website is ideacenter.org. But if Idea Clubs would, on your Google search engine, would get you there, I'm sure. And there are even adult Idea Clubs that people found just to get together for the discussions. Now, this is the self-starting sort of thing that's happening, because people are excited about the issues and about it, that the controversy is actually going somewhere. They don't feel powerless anymore. They feel like some big change may be coming. Now, that's one self-starting operation that I'm going to mention now, and I'm going to mention another one right next. I have been pleased to note that we have here today and also last night, obviously, some homeschooling families. And youngsters of various ages that will come and sit very attentively through a program on this subject. It's impressive. I believe that the homeschooling movement is the great revolutionary movement of our time in the United States. All through my career, I was concerned about the way public education was having so many failures. And it was, of course, we know that it's religiously, it's very hostile to Christian thinking. And so we need to open that up somewhat. And it isn't doing a good job of educating in many other ways as well. Now, when I was a young parent, we thought the only thing we could do is either we could think about paying for private schools, or you could ask the government to provide vouchers, that you needed to have some big-scale solution like that. You had to have professionals doing the educating for you. So you had to pay for that one way or another. It never occurred to us that it was possible for parents just to start doing it. It's like in that sneaker commercial, just do it. And that's what these folks are doing, so that we have something like, the estimates vary, but the low estimates of the number of youngsters being homeschooled today are on the order of 1 million. The higher ones, 2 million to 5 million. And it's hard to get an exact count because The purpose of the whole thing is to get under the radar screen of the regulators. They don't want to file a lot of reports. but it's an amazing thing. I just got a message yesterday before leaving. I remember from a friend of mine, a woman who is a law professor at Regent University, a law school in Virginia. Someone in the audience was asking me about law schools and Regent University, a Christian law school. Here's a woman who's a professor there, a good friend of mine, and her husband is a an agent who represents Major League Baseball players. Now, so these are not stay-at-home, you know, this is a woman who's a lawyer, a law professor, and so on, homeschooling their kids with the father, the two parents doing it, and she wrote to me and said how rewarding it is, what a rewarding experience. That you have people willing to make that kind of commitment. And since in so many cases doing such a wonderful job of it, I am really impressed. And when I get the chance, sometimes reporters will ask anyone who's in the public view, who are your heroes? Who do you admire most? And I always answer, homeschooling moms. Because, I want to, you know, say to the youngsters here too, that you are part of, you know, a great movement. When you're homeschooled, we're going to have tens of thousands of young people going into the universities in another decade. They're already going into the universities and some of the finest universities, and they have been taught to think for themselves and to critique the official stories of our culture, including the theory of evolution. And in fact, homeschooling families very widely use my books, which is something I'm very glad to see. And so this is enormously important in anyone, whether they're a homeschooling parent or not, who is helping to get the word out, as these idea center people are, and just get people to get used to thinking about the issues, is doing, I think, a mighty work for the truth. Because eventually we will get such a large number of people who are aware of the issues that it won't matter that the newspapers don't report them honestly. See, you have newspapers here in Seattle, particularly, that are notoriously biased. And this is not unusual. It's true in my part of the West Coast, too. And all, you can't expect any honest reporting of the scientific controversies. They'll just take the official line of the mandarins of science and tell that. And they keep trying to get their readers to believe that the only people who doubt the theory of evolution are completely ignorant of all the scientific evidence and just thump their Bibles. And that the movie Inherit the Wind tells the truth about Christian persecution of teachers and all. And all of these lies, they just get repeated again and again. So we have to get around those institutions. So we have now the homeschooling movement. We have the Internet, the World Wide Web. We have the talk radio, from which so many people are getting their news of public affairs from. And it's possible for anyone to make a contribution in any of these areas. One area is in the churches. I have to say, now, of course, there are some churches, they're liberal churches who are conformed to the culture, and naturalistic ways of thinking. That's the case with all the mainstream denominations. My own congregation, the First Presbyterian Church of Berkeley, is very evangelical and biblically faithful, but the denomination, PCUSA, as I'm sure I don't have to waste a lot of time trying to persuade people who attend an Orthodox Presbyterian church of this denomination. I refer to it as our semi-apostate denomination, and I always add, and that's giving them the benefit of the doubt. Yes. But now I'm not speaking of the bad churches, like that denomination in its liberal congregations. But even the good churches with good pastors rarely do a good job of educating people about the evolution controversy. They don't want to get into it. They feel inadequate, or the pastors often feel that they aren't adequate to do it, and they feel with some justification that it will split the congregation. See, that there will be people in the congregation who are faithful in many ways, but who are very upset when they hear the theory of evolution being challenged. This is true in the Christian colleges. You know, I point out in chapter 2, I think, of the right questions that I have discovered that at the typical Christian college, it is considered far more offensive to deny the truth of the theory of evolution than to deny the divinity of Christ or the existence of God. And that's the way the professors act. That's just the truth. That they're very protective of this theory of evolution because their whole self-respect, you see, that I'm an intellectual and not a Bible-thumping fundamentalist, is bound up with belief in the theory of evolution. Well, those are some of the things about the controversy that the topic for this last lecture is how the controversy stands now. There are some things that are discouraging and some things that are encouraging. Okay. It's discouraging, of course, that the public school system is totally under the domination of the scientific reductionists and of evolution, and that you can't get any, it's so hard to get any recognition that there's anything to be doubtful about, and the textbooks contain outright erroneous or fraudulent information, and the publishers don't care. It supports evolution. What else matters? So that's a little discouraging. But then, to see encouraging, you find all these people that are getting around that in one way or another, especially through homeschooling. And that's where a lot of the future leaders are going to come from, is those homeschooled families. And I want to encourage the youngsters in those families to think about the leadership role you'll probably have. Be sure and learn a whole lot while you're being educated, because you'll have a tremendously exciting world to move into where great changes are taking place and old myths and lies are being overturned, and you can have a role in that. And isn't that exciting to think that that could be the case? Well, it can. And I'll help to show you something about how that's going to occur in this final lecture. So those are encouraging developments. It's discouraging that so many people, as I say, and many leaders and pastors, even in the good churches, and that's the ones I'm going to talk about now, that are basically good, biblically faithful, and really dedicated, don't understand the vital importance of educating the congregations in the theory of evolution and its problems. Now, the reason why they don't understand it is because they think, well, this is just a question of a particular scientific theory. And we can leave that to the professors and the scientists to talk about. We can just tell, you know, we don't have to worry about that. We can talk about Jesus and his love. it's not essential. So what I try to explain in the churches particularly, and every audience, is that the topic here is not a particular scientific theory. That is a misunderstanding to imagine that that's what we're talking about. The real topic is the reality of God. Is God real or illusory? Did God create man or did man invent God? That's what the topic is. And so if God did not create us, then there really isn't any importance to Jesus and his love. Who is this Jesus? Just another teacher 2,000 years ago who didn't know as much as we know now. He didn't even know about theory of evolution. So why should we pay any attention to him? that you have to have that the doctrine of creation by God is fundamental to everything else. It's not optional. And the message of the theory of evolution is that nature and not God is our creator. But now what's encouraging, of course, is more and more people are understanding that, and more pastors are understanding that. I'm in great demand at churches just because the pastors want the congregations to understand that importance and not to imagine that this is something that they can't understand. And it is something that you don't have to be a PhD or even a college graduate to understand what evolution is about. I've often been asked by reporters and also by science professors and all, well, how is it that you you know, a law professor who's not a biologist can be lecturing around the country and the world on this topic. And who do you think you are? And I always say that from Charles Darwin at the beginning down to Richard Dawkins and Stephen Jay Gould and other famous figures of evolution today, every single one of those gurus of evolution wrote books for the ordinary reader, not just for the scientific specialist. And not one of those writers, and in not one of those books, ever said, this is just too complicated and specialized for ordinary people. Leave this to the professional biologists. No, on the contrary, they say, it's something that anyone can understand and you can see that it's true. Right? Once you understand what it is, you'll see immediately how it must be true. So I said, well, what I am doing in these lectures, I am speaking as the self-appointed representative of all the readers of all those books. And I am explaining to the authors why their logic is fallacious. And that when you understand the theory, what you will see is that it is true only if, this is the big if you accept the starting point assumption, you see, which is, science tells us what is real as opposed to unreal, and science assumes that only nature is real and that God is unreal. So you start out by assuming the conclusion. Well, then you get to the conclusion. But if you state, on the other hand, that the proposition here is a hypothesis, a tentative thought that maybe nature can do its own creating, and then ask yourself, does the evidence support that conclusion or does it not support it? Then you will see that the evidence that nature can do its own creating, can create these marvelously complex structures, has never been forthcoming. And so understanding leads to more and more doubt, not more and more belief of the theory. And the materials that are available, the books by all of the authors affiliated with the Discovery Institute, for example, and videotapes, the tapes go with that, are now sufficient that any small-scale educational program has plenty of aids to go along with it. And people watch these things and they get together and talk about them and hold each other accountable for understanding and talking sense about them. That's what the idea clubs do. It's what is being done everywhere. Now, I do not claim an enormous amount of originality for the ideas that I have written in my books, as is generally true with anything that's important. There are precursors. There are people who have pointed out, that the Darwinian mechanism doesn't really have creative power. They pointed out the difference between microevolution, so-called, which isn't really evolution at all. It's just back-and-forth variations, like in that peppered case I talked about. They pointed out the difference between that and the big story of evolution, the creation of brand-new things that didn't exist before. I think that I did probably contribute something new, to the ongoing discussion. And if you want to read about this, perhaps the best place to read about it is the foreword to my latest book, The Right Questions, by Nancy Piercy. Nancy Piercy is a name that's probably best known to some of you as the co-author of the book How Now Shall We Live, that always advertises by Chuck Colson. Well, Nancy is the co-author of that book. Her name is on the book, but it isn't always given as much prominence when it's mentioned. So Nancy, what I did when I came into the struggle of over evolution and creation was to say, there is a way to win this. And I think that the creationist side of the argument had become so accustomed to losing that they didn't imagine anything else to do except to continue losing. See, so they would spend their time, for example, arguing with other creationists about details. The ongoing battle between young Earth and old Earth creationists was the most noteworthy sign of that. But all sorts of infighting within the groups, because everybody was saying the important thing is for everybody to get the answers all right, which means to come to all the same answers that I have come to. And so most of the arguing is going on among the creationists, and they aren't getting anywhere. They aren't forming an effective front against the Darwinists. I thought now, what needs to be done is, in the first place, to concentrate on an issue that brings these groups together, that unites the divided people. And the issue that we can bring everybody together on is the inadequacy of the Darwinian mechanism. That's right, that we all have to dispute the proposition that natural selection has the power to do the creating, so you don't need God. So let's get together and argue that point first and put aside the other points until some later date when we've won the first point. And that achieving this degree of unity is a really important first step forward. And we do not have to settle all of our other disagreements in order to do that. So, you see, now I found that, for example, one faction that is allied with my group, the Intelligent Design Movement, one of our important constituencies is a group of people who have got their degrees in the physical sciences. They're physicists, they're astronomers, and they're believers in the Big Bang astronomy and all the physical theory, and they are very disapproving of young Earth creationists. They think that they could get the scientific world to consider that the Big Bang is a creation event and it's evidence of the existence of a creator if it weren't for these young Earth creationists who are insisting on the Genesis literalism. Say, and so they tend to make war on the young Earth creationists. Well, this, to my mind, is futile. Make war on the Darwinists and have peace. You know, within the movement of the people who believe in creation. I said, no, what for those people? I said, the right stance to take is don't take a position on the age of the earth if you don't have to. Emphasize the issue on which we agree. Well, these physicists would sometimes say to me, well, you see, we could get the other physicists to agree with us if we could just get these young earth creationists out of the way. And I would explain to them, no, that's not true. Anything that reminds them of God is unacceptable. Say, yeah, you aren't going to win the support of the scientific materialists by denouncing the young Earth creationists. See, they'll tell you that. I hear this all the time. They'll say, well, Phil, show your good faith. Denounce the young earthers. See, that's what the Darwinists would like me to do. Say, show that I'm reading. That's what Richard Dawkins wanted me to do, or accept something. And then they'll say, well, thank you for that. Now you've estranged all your friends. And there's less reason for us to pay attention to you than ever before. So I said, no, I want all of the people that say you need a creator to do the creating to be working together to make the essential first breakthrough. And so I want to treat both sides of this controversy with respect. So that's step number one, is to achieve this unity. I can say, by the way, that one person I've talked to a number of times about this, who very much agrees with me, those of you who are young earthers, I think, probably need to hear this, is Dwayne Gish, the chief debating representative of the Institute for Creation Research. He believes in the young earth, and he affirms it, but he tries to avoid referring to it as much as he can when he's lecturing, because Dwayne is a biochemist by profession. What he knows is biology. See? And he knows that what the key issue in the debate is whether the Darwinian mechanism has creative power or whether it doesn't. So he wants to lead with that issue. See? And then after we make the breakthrough on that issue, then we can spend all the time we want debating and researching what the age of the earth is. We'll be doing that in an entirely new situation, because see, once the scientific community has to acknowledge that the Darwinian theory was false, they're going to have to be more humble about a lot of other things. See, because they put a lot of their prestige into that theory. So that, in my mind, is the strategy for winning. I have made a lot of friendships across this border between people who are pretty bitterly divided, you see, over that issue. But both the Institute for Creation Research in Southern California and Hugh Ross's Reasons to Believe, which is vehemently older, based on astronomy, they both sell my books. And I have cordial relationships. And so this bringing about unity, of course, this is the way a legal strategist will think about a controversy. You want to get allies, and you need allies, and get as many as you can. Now, that was the first thing that I emphasized in coming into the movement with the publication of Darwin on Trial, now about 14 years ago, more than a dozen years ago. And the other thing that I've emphasized, I want people to understand, is that in this controversy, it is the Darwinists who have to be afraid of freedom of thought and freedom of speech, not the creationists. We don't need to take dogmatic positions. We don't need to do things like, for example, one of the things that can be a really big mistake is when the alumni of some Christian college write into the president and demand that some professor be fired. See, because the professor isn't orthodox on the creation issue or whatever. Now, what happens, then you get a mighty backlash. The professors all gather around the issue and wave the flag of academic freedom. Right? And this brings them to, this unifies them against the outsider. On behalf of a colleague, it has a negative effect. It doesn't work. What the much better thing to do is to come on that college campus and to say what we need to do is open up the discussion. Let's have an idea club there. Let's have open debate. Let's have guest speakers who will raise the issues that the students need to consider if the professors aren't willing to raise those issues. And let's get the discussion going, and we'll have the students asking the professors about that in class. Why are you so afraid to have Philip Johnson come and lecture on your, Christian college campus? See, and they are. Many of these professors are desperate to keep speakers like me away because they're afraid the students will believe what we're saying. But you see, it's always opening it up to freedom of thought, not shutting it down. We don't have to defend a dogma. Any free conversation, free debate is going to go our way. And so I took up this strategy of emphasizing freedom of thought and freedom of speech as the national strategy. And the great moment of this came in 2001. I had been lecturing in the Washington, D.C. area on the subject that what we ought to be doing in the schools with respect to the evolution controversy is that the schools ought to teach the controversy. They ought to teach the official theory. I say we never take the line, don't teach evolution, because we don't like it. That's the wrong line to take. You see, that gives the other side the freedom club to wield, and they wield it very successfully when you give it to them. See, so they say, no, what we want is evolution to be taught, but a good teaching of evolution will also teach the reasons why so many people find the theory unconvincing. Teach the controversy, fairly and honestly. Among the people who I spoke to on this Washington trip was Senator Rick Santorum, who sent an email when I was back in California, saying he was intending to introduce a Teach the Controversy amendment to the President's Leave No Child Behind Education Act that was going through Congress at that time. And that's what he was going to do. I didn't think he'd get any votes for it. His staff told me, well, we're not sure this is a good idea at all. We can't talk him out of it. So I thought, well, I should at least give the senator a well-drafted amendment. And it's up to him to decide
whether it's a winner or not, whether he, because it'd be embarrassing if it didn't get very many votes and support in the U.S. Senate. So here's what I wrote for him. Santorum resolution for the to debate on the Leave No Child Behind Education Act. It's all explained in Chapter 1 of my book, The Right Questions, as well. The resolution is, it is the sense of the Senate that good science education should prepare students to distinguish the data and testable theories of science from philosophical or religious claims that are made in the name of science. Very simple. Good science education teaches students to know the difference between testable theories of science that can be tested against the evidence, and on the other hand, philosophical or religious claims made in the name of science. Who could disagree with that? Of course, students ought to learn how to do that sort of thing. First, end of first sentence. Second sentence, where biological evolution is taught, the curriculum should help students to understand why the subject generates so much continuing controversy and should prepare the students to be informed participants in public discussions regarding the subject. Let's teach the controversy. The soundbite for that sentence. Prepare them to be informed participants in public discussions to understand the controversy. Well, when Rick Santorum moved that amendment in the Senate, he said that the purpose of this amendment is to safeguard intellectual freedom in discussions of evolution and creation. Rick told me later that so the Democratic senators had been afraid that what he was going to introduce was a pro-life amendment. That it had to do with abortion. And they were amazed and relieved when it didn't. And they thought that this was completely harmless. It's just for freedom of thought, intellectual freedom. That's liberal. It's a liberal value and so on. And so the floor manager for the Democrats on the education bill stood up, and that was a senator you've heard of, Ted Kennedy. And he said, I endorse this resolution, and I hope every senator will vote for it. This is just what we need, is open discussion of the alternatives. And the vote was taken, and the Santorum resolution passed the Senate by a vote of 91-8. 91-8. Now, following that, I was out of commission for some time. That's when I had a stroke. Not brought on by the news, but I had it. But friends of mine including Bruce Chapman, the president of the Discovery Institute here in Seattle, along with Senator Santorum and other friendly legislators in the House and the Senate, I kept this measure alive. Now, you see, it wasn't part of the bill itself. It was just a resolution that the Senate passed. And the House passed the Education Act, the Leave No Child Behind Education Act, without a comparable sense of the House resolution. But our friends in Washington and the House and the Senate got together, and they saw that the resolution was included in the conference committee report, which accompanied the Education Act and was approved by both houses of Congress. You see, and the committee report is what tells the courts how to construe the language which is in the Act, like words like science and education. See, so it's very authoritative. House and Senate Joint Committee, Conference Committee report, saying how the Act is to be construed is very authoritative when it gets to the administrative agencies or to the courts and explaining how the bill is to be interpreted. So this was added to the conference committee report. Now, by this time, the science hierarchy, the national leaders of the scientific world that decide where the funding is to go, and the education lobby, like the teachers' unions, had all gone berserk. See, nobody realized what was going on until the measure passed the Senate. Because I think that the liberal senators, and all the liberals voted for it, Kerry, Edwards, Ted Kennedy, Barbara Boxer, the whole crew voted for it. And I'm sure that the explanation for this is that they did not realize what the consequences would be. See, the freedom of thought, intellectual freedom, sounded very good to them. But when it got passed the Senate by such an overwhelming vote, the science educators said, "Do you realize what you have done? We're in big trouble." See, if a debate is held on this basis, it's true, of course, that the bill, what the Santorum resolution does not say is that the educating on this subject, on the teaching of the controversy, will be done by Phil Johnson and his friends. No, it would be done by the same teacher, the members of the teachers' union, and the, you know, under the direction of the scientific leadership and all. But even so, they know that they would have to deal with the real issues. See, students would say, well, is this claim that natural selection has creative power scientific? Is it a testable theory? Or is it a philosophical claim made in the name of science? At home, in the college classes, you see, the homeschooled students would be coming in there and asking those questions, and the professors would be embarrassed. And if you deal with it at the high school level, if it's in the law that applies at the high school level, that means it has to be taught at the university level, too. The reason why these things come in at the high schools is because that's where the public can get its word in. See, and that's where you can get some kind of legal provision. But once you put it in there for the high schools, then the universities have to take it up, and that's where we really want the debate to occur, is at the top level. Now, there will be continuing legal battles about whether this is a compulsory, you know, part of the law or not. But I don't like to emphasize that issue. When I'm called up and when I get an opportunity to speak on the Santorum language and all, what I say is that it is actually part of the Act. The Department of Education has said it will use this language to interpret, you know, the Act. It's authoritative. But that's a secondary issue to me. The more important claim, the more important thing to understand is that this language provides a statement of educational policy, which ought to be adopted throughout the educational world just because it's good educational policy, whether it's legally required or not. And the active principle here, the principle of policy that's involved, is that in this country, we are educating students not to be robots who just carry out the instructions that they're given by authorities from on high, but to be free citizens in a self-governing society. And what that means specifically is that the high school students of today, you know, will be in adulthood, they'll be serving on juries where they will have to evaluate scientific testimony. They will be elected to public office, where they will have to evaluate scientific issues and tell the difference between genuine scientific work and bluffing in the name of science. The basic principle here. Many of them will become judges. They have to decide whether scientific claims should be admitted into court. If they're on juries, then after the scientific claim has been made in court, they have to decide whether to believe it or not. So in all of these ways, we are educating students for citizenship. And when we are educating them for citizenship, then isn't it obvious that when 90% of their fellow citizens are skeptical of the theory of evolution to one degree or another, that they should understand what that controversy is about and be prepared to become informed participants in public discussions regarding the subject? And you see, the response from the scientific hierarchy was there shouldn't be any public discussions regarding this subject. Any discussions should be carried out only in our circles. And then the job of the people is just to obey whatever we tell them and to believe what we tell them that they ought to believe. Well, in a free society, that's unacceptable. And so the principle here is what I think is the simply unimpeachable, uncontestable educational principle that we are educating students to be free citizens in a self-governing society, and they have to understand how to evaluate the claims of experts in areas that are, in fact, highly controversial in the culture. It's a very modest proposition. Now, The other thing to understand is that when we in the intelligent design movement say that the Santorum language is the language in which we want the discussion of the claims of evolutionary naturalism, scientific reductionism, this is the context, the language which we want to govern the framework of the debates. We are saying that because we know that our position has nothing to fear from intellectual freedom, and their position has everything to fear from it. See, so that all we need is intellectual freedom, a fair discussion with all of the issues on the table in on a level playing field. You see, where the Darwinists can't just say, well, we define science as materialism, as explaining everything on the basis of material causes, so that's the end of the discussion. Because we've imposed this definition, there's nothing to discuss. And it's all over. Well, we just have to say, you can't make that move. You have to leave the discussion open to a fair consideration of the evidence, and you have to differentiate between the philosophical claim that nature is all there is and the testable scientific theories, because they're on a different level. And this is some intellectual freedom, is what Rick Santorum said, and the other principle is intellectual honesty. So who is against intellectual honesty and intellectual freedom? The answer is plenty of people. But they don't like to admit it. It weakens their position a great deal if they have to admit that. Now, so, you see, when you understand this, when you understand the Santorum Amendment and the principle behind it, then you can see that this is a winner. Because, you see, in order to maintain their position indefinitely, the other side, the Darwinists, have to rely on the power of government, the power of the media, to distort the discussion, to say, well, it's only over the book of Genesis, and certain Genesis literalists who don't know any scientific evidence. They have to rely on their power to tell lies and get away with it. But that's hard to rely on in this day of the internet and talk radio and all. You don't just have a few gatekeepers. It's all like Walter Cronkite used to be on television. It's all anybody ever hears, you see. They've lost that control. And so they can't maintain that. And they have to use the power of government to fire teachers, you know, who raise awkward questions. See, we have to take the freedom of thought, the freedom issues for our own, and let them be the oppressors. And that's a losing position. Because unless they are prepared to go all of the way with firing squads and concentration camps, you know, they can't win that way. And I think, to their credit, they are not are able to go all the way with these measures. And even those measures didn't work for Hitler's Germany or Stalin's Russia indefinitely. So you see, that's why this is a winning game. And this is why, even though the other side has all the money and control of the educational system and the media, I think their position is desperate. Because, you'll see, we can take the high ground of liberal moral freedom and intellectual freedom and intellectual honesty. And it is extremely important that people who are arguing these issues stick to that high ground. See, that's why I don't say, don't go into the college and say, Mr. President, you know, fire this obnoxious teacher. You know, that's a way to lose. Always be opening up the discussion to more freedom. It's a sign of weakness when you feel you have to rely on authority, because we don't have to rely on it. And so when people introduce resolutions in local school boards, this is usually futile anyway, because a local school board can't do anything except what the higher authorities tell it. You know, the attorney general and the governor willing to support. But when they do introduce something, the important thing, what I recommend, is that people use the exact language of the Santorum resolution. You see, because you can use language that has the imprimatur of Congress. That makes it hard for the newspapers to say that it's made up by a bunch of kooks. Well, now, that, depending on what your opinion of Congress is, that might still be accurate, but you see, it has the authority of a 91-8 vote in the Senate. If it comes into the political campaign this year, which I hope it will, You see, Senator Kerry and Senator Edwards both voted for a Santorum Amendment. The 8 negative votes were all Republicans who don't understand the issue. And so you see what a winner this freedom of the intellectual freedom, intellectual honesty approach is. It just needs people who understand it and who understand why it is that that's all we need in order to win. There are people who can't believe it. It seems too good to be true. They think, oh, no, we've got to somehow, you know, impose our rules in order to win the debate. No, we don't. We just need to rely on this, the principles of intellectual freedom and intellectual honesty. And this is what I hope all of these homeschooling youngsters are learning. Intellectual freedom and intellectual honesty, careful evaluation of the issues, and being logical, being consistent, is what we need. Now, sometimes that's uncomfortable. I always warn, you know, parents and educators who are teaching the techniques of intellectual freedom and intellectual honesty, identifying the right questions and applying logic to them. You got to be aware these youngsters will apply this to you. And, you know, the things that you want them to believe that you may not be completely logical are going to get questioned. Well, that's good for us. You know, skeptics are an important part of the community of faith, in my opinion. Right? They help keep us honest. The skeptical questions that we have to think through what we believe. And we don't have to be afraid of that. You know, the Christian faith and the Bible have undergone the most thorough job of intellectual demolition that could possibly be done. See, by the scholars of the 19th and 20th century. And we have nothing worse can happen to us than has already happened. You know, it's other possessions that have not had that testing and come through that fire. That is why I face the future with such a sense of confidence, and I want to encourage the young people here to think that way too, that your future can be such an exciting one that you can take part in the great changes that are coming and new ways of thinking, and it's so important to use your time now well that you're properly prepared. You learn things, I say, you know, learn languages. Now, you know, not just languages like, you know, French and Spanish. That's one kind of language. Another kind of language is mathematics. Computer languages. And music is a language. But, you know, you learn different ways of communicating so that you can communicate with a wide variety of people. Nobody learns them all, of course. But you know, you maximize your potential to have an impact on the world from your knowledge and your ability to communicate, and then you can have a very, very exciting future. So I hope that some of what we in the intelligent design movement have done will help to pave the way for your greater accomplishments, you know, as you come into maturity and are able to make them in the future. And I thank all you people, and particularly the young ones, for having been present in such an attentive audience.